say that we should have some confidentiality of the core material or the Alice's secret. There should be something at least that only Alice can do. So we said, okay, then Alice can encrypt things. And then we said, okay, that helps us against somebody learning our details, but it doesn't prevent them from reusing it, from replaying it. So then we said we needed to add some freshness also to the communication. Right? So let's think about some different ways to do that. So now we can think about it as a little bit more formal way. So if we have Alice and Bob and they share the DK, Bob can send nonce to Alice. Alice can take the hash of her key, which she has, together with the nonce, and then send the result back to Bob. So in other words, what we have is there's something that's only attached to this transaction, but at the same time, we have also only something that Alice can do. So only Alice can calculate this hash of the nonce with EK, because Alice is the only other person than Bob that has this EK. Right. So normally in protocols, lots of background things happen as well. So for example, Alice has to tell Bob first, hi, I am Alice, I want to talk to you. And then following that, Bob will basically challenge Alice with the nonce. But in general, when we're interested in the security protocols, we only keep the part that's actually relevant to what we try to do. So all this nice setup or any niceties that happened originally will basically take out of it. Okay. So other ways that we can do exactly the same thing. Okay? Bob can send a nonce to Alice. Alice can calculate the MAC of the nonce using PK. So similarly, we have some freshness from the nonce, which links it to the now, to this transaction, and we are doing a MAC with PK, which theoretically only Alice can do. Right? Then we can also, Bob can also encrypt the nonce and send it to Alice. That means Alice is the only one that can decrypt this message, recover the nonce, and send it back to Bob. And then finally, Bob can just send the nonce to Alice. She can encrypt it and send it back. Right, so every time we now see there's something that gives us something we call freshness, something that links it to one specific transaction, links it to now, because Bob is now using this nonce. Next time, he's going to use a different one. Right, and every single time there's something that only Alice can do. Right, so only Alice can calculate the MAC, she's the other one with the EK. Or only Alice can decrypt the nonce, because she's the other one with EK. Or only Alice can encrypt the nonce, because she's the other one with EK. Right, so now we're getting the idea. There's something that only Alice can do, and then there's something that shows that Alice has done that something now. Right, not yesterday or last week, right now. Right. So in terms of public key notations and assumptions, we can do the same thing with asymmetric crypto. If we say that curly brackets is encrypting with the public key of Alice, and square brackets is signing the message M with the private key of Alice, then what can we do? Bob can encrypt R with Alice's public key. Alice is the only one that can decrypt this message, because he's the only one with the private key. And then she sends R back to Bob. Similarly, Bob can send R to Alice. Alice can sign this R, because she's the only one with the private key, so she's the only one who can sign, and she sends it back to Bob. So once again, we have something only Alice can do, which is decrypt, something only Alice can do, which is sign, and Alice is doing it on a number that is linking it to the now. Right? Something that's going to happen right now. Okay. So now we can really formalize it. Right? And this basically comes from the terminology that they use in the ISO 9789 standard, which is basically the authentication standard, in which case where they define a lot of different options for you to authenticate somebody to somebody else or people to each other. So in any authentication protocol, we'll have a claimant, we'll have a principal, and we will have a verifier. So a claimant will basically tell the verifier that they are the principal. Okay. So I tell you that I am Alice. Right? I am the claimant because I am telling you who I am. You are the verifier because you have to now decide whether I am actually the person I'm claiming to be or not. And Alice is the principal because that's the person I am claiming to be. So in other words, if you think about it very formally, the verifier's job is to make sure that the claimant and the principal is the same person. The person that they are talking to, telling them that they are Alice, they have to actually ensure that that person talking to them is actually Alice. The Venn diagram authentication protocol is any sequence of messages that goes between these two parties that is designed in such a way that it allows the verifier to confirm or verify the identity of the claimant. Right. So we have two types of authentication protocol. They can either be unilateral or mutual. Unilateral means during the protocol, when the protocol is finished, one party is authenticated to the other. In mutual authentication, both parties are authenticated to each other. So once the protocol is finished, Alice is authenticated to Bob, Bob is authenticated to Alice. In unilateral authentication, Alice is authenticated to Bob, or Bob is authenticated to Alice. Right. So basically, our protocol can only be messages going between each other, right? So we're sending some data between Alice and Bob. So how do they decide that somebody's actually been authenticated? So before, when we were talking about this, looking at the protocols, we said, well, if I want to make sure that I'm talking to Alice, there should be something that only Alice can do, and there must be something that links the fact that Alice has done it just now, right? So when we map those things back to security services, the first requirement is the message that I receive must have come from the principal, right? So if somebody sends me a message saying, I am Alice, the message that I receive should be from Alice. It must be received from Alice. In other words, we need data origin authentication. That is step number one. However, we must also make sure that that message was generated recently or not. And that is our freshness. Only if we have both of these conditions satisfied can we say that we've authenticated anyone. So if I get a message that says, I am Alice, here is some crypto stuff, that message must have data origin authentication. In other words, that message I should be able to verify has been made by Alice. And secondly, that message must also have freshness. In other words, Alice has made this message, and she has made it now. Right now, during this person talking to me. Then I know that the person I'm talking to is Alice. So we need both of these conditions. Right. So in terms of origin authentication, last week we discussed maps. We also discussed digital signature schemes. Both of these will give you data origin authentication. If Alice signs the message and sends it to me, I verify the signature, I know that Alice has made this message. It has not been modified. Right. Last week we basically talked about encryption as a method of providing integrity, and we said in general encryption does not provide us with any integrity check. So if I like just encrypt some messages and send it to you, you don't really know that what you receive is correct. However, in this special case, when we are defining protocols, if we give it some help, encryption can also be a third method of data origin authentication. So how would that work, right? So encryption can check integrity if the receiver had some way of knowing that the message made sense, right? So normally if I'm just sending you data in general, it's very difficult for you to say, well, this data is correct or not correct or it makes sense, right? In authentication protocols, we can use something called a manipulation detection code, or an MDC, and we can basically use that on the plain text before the encryption, so that when the receiver decrypts it, they can check whether this code is still correct. Right? So for example, we had one manipulation detection code which heads in that direction, and that was a hash. Right? get a valid hash value for the data, that could be a way of seeing whether the data makes sense or not, right? However, the easiest way to do this, we just have the receiver know the exact data that they should be receiving, right? So earlier when we were basically looking at things like this, right? Bob sends nonce to Alice, Alice encrypts nonce and sends it back to Bob. So we have freshness from the nonce, so that's something that's only happening now. And our data origin authentication comes from the encryption, because Alice is the only one to encrypt with EK, and Bob already knows the answer he should be getting. Right? If Alice sends him anything back and he encrypts it and it's not the nonce he already sent, Bob will reject it. Right? So Bob knows what the data is that's coming in. So if anyone modifies it, if he decrypts it, he will know. Right. So in the context of authentication protocols, if we allow for encryption to be set up in that way, it is an effective way of giving us data origin authentication. Right. How about the second thing? How about freshness? So we have two common ways to check freshness. The one is nonces. Sort of looked at them already when we looked at the various examples. So this is called a challenge response protocol. I send you a challenge, you do something that challenge, you send it back. The challenge is usually a nonce or a random number. Okay? The first one, however, could also be a timestamp. Right? I can simply take the current time, I can put that into my message somehow and send it to the verifier. So timestamps can be both logical or clock-based. Okay. So if we look at clock-based timestamps, it's simply taking the current time in the message. When was this message created? Send it to the verifier. The only problem with this is that actually the two parties, the sender and the receiver, the claimant and the verifier, should have securely synchronized clocks. If an attacker can come along and mess with either one of their clocks, right, they can basically break the algorithm. You have to think about if I can mess with the verifier's clock and set their time ahead by a day, or make them a day slow, right? And today Alice sent a message to that verifier and I intercept it, and then I wait a day and then I send it to that guy. And that guy's going to say, oh, it's fresh because received this message from 1 second ago, even though it's from a day ago, right? And in practice, it's not so easy to provide such clocks, right? Synchronized clocks is actually a research area in itself, not really for security, but for networking people. They love doing clock synchronization as research, because it's actually quite a difficult problem. How accurately you can synchronize them, and they drift all the time, right? So if you had two watches, for example, and you put them next to each other and you synchronize them in the morning, I'm pretty sure by the evening, one of them would be 1 or 2 seconds fast or slow. Right? You can get some really, really accurate clocks, like the ones they use in satellite receivers for positioning, right? Like GPS satellites, GLONASS, that kind of thing. But of course, they're very expensive. Right? They're very big clocks. And even they tend to drift a little bit. So therefore, you need to have a way to synchronize them regularly. And then you would need to have security also for everyone concerned, so you can do this security. So it's not impossible, but it's just something that needs to be kept in mind. Right. So other things that we need to think about when we're going to use clock-based timestamps is reliability. Right. So if I send a message to somebody else, this message does not travel instantly. It has to go through some network. It might cover or encounter some congestion. Things might be delayed. Maybe the packet is dropped and I try to retransmit it, which means now the receiver gets it like 5 seconds from now, rather than immediately, right? How do we deal with that? So normally what happens is the receiver cannot just say, oh, the message was sent 1 nanosecond ago, so I consider it fresh. The receiver must have something called the window of acceptance, right? And this means Okay, I will tag any packet that I think was sent in the last 30 seconds or 15 seconds. So now, of course, immediately you have a trade-off. So you can say, okay, the shorter my window of acceptance, the more secure my system, because the shortest opportunity there is for replay, right? Alternatively, the longer I make my window of acceptance, the more reliability I have. The more messages I will accept as valid than was sent by a valid recipient, even though they were subject to difficult conditions. So normally how this would work is an attacker will a verifier will set a window of acceptance, and it will log all the messages that it got at that time, right? So if it gets a message from Alice, let's say at 9:01, 9 o'clock and 1 second, and its window of acceptance is 30 seconds, it will not take another message from Alice before 30 seconds after 9 o'clock, right? Because it will keep track of all the messages that comes in within that window, right? And if there's already a message from Alice, it will reject it. It will only take a new message from Alice after 30 seconds after 9. Right. The next way we can do freshness is using logical timestamps. So logical timestamps don't use clocks, but they use sequence numbers or counters. Okay? If you are familiar with networking and you study TCP, it's sort of something similar how TCP uses counters to set up sessions between different parties, make sure that all the messages are securely, they're not reliably delivered. So in this case, when we have Alice and Bob will maintain a counter which signifies the number of messages that Alice has sent to Bob and the number of messages that Bob has sent to Alice. So for the moment, we just assume that Alice is sending Bob numbers. So they have a counter that counts how many messages Alice has sent to Bob. Okay? So whenever Alice sends any message to Bob, this counter is increased by 1. Okay? So Alice will have a number. It now wants, let's say, number 10. It wants to send a message to Bob. So it goes, okay, I increment it to 11. I put the 11 in the message and I send it to Bob. Bob gets this message. He looks at this number. He says, okay, the last time Alice sent me a number, the number was 10. My current number for Alice is 10. 11 is larger than 10. It's fresher than 10. So therefore, I accept this message. Right? And then Bob increments his counter to 11. The next time, Alice will send 12. If Alice somehow sends Bob a message with the value 8, Bob will say, okay, but my current value is 11. And now I'm getting a message from Alice with 8. This message must be old, I'm going to reject it and not accept it, right? So whenever Bob gets a message, he looks at the number that Alice has sent, and if it's a fresh number, he sets his own number equal to that number. The additional reason for that is also reliability. Let's say Alice sends the message 11, Bob's counter value is 10, okay? But that message goes missing, and Alice realizes she has to send again. That means she makes a new message equal to 12. So when Bob receives it this time, he sees, okay, 12, I didn't get an 11, but 12 is still newer than 10. So somewhere along the line, the message must have gone missing. So I will set my own counter to 12. And immediately, Alice and Bob is synchronized again. Right. So Bob doesn't really care if the message is much bigger than his own number, but he does care if the message number is smaller than his current number. Okay. And then the main alternative to the use of timestamps for the logical or time-based is then, of course, nonces. Alright? So Alice generates a new random nonce and sends it to Bob. Bob inputs his nonce and replies it. So nonces are a bit of an interesting thing because sometimes they are random, right? But strictly speaking, a counter is also a nonce. If I just increment a counter every single time and set the next counter value to Alice, and my counter is really long and unlikely to wrap around, right? It means every single time I talk to Alice, I will have a new number. Okay. So this works perfectly well for some protocols, right? For other protocols, it would not work, right? So once again, if we go sort of and look at something simple, look at this example here, in this example, a counter would work fine, right? Bob sends a counter value to Alice. Bob sends 10 to Alice. Bob, Alice encrypts 10, sends it back to Bob. Bob sends 11 to Alice. Alice encrypts 11, sends it back to Bob. He's okay. It doesn't work here though, because if I know Bob is just using a counter, and Bob encrypts 10 and sends it to Alice, and Alice sends back 10, and tomorrow I see, oh, Bob is sending another encrypted one to Alice, I also know the answer is going to be there, because I know Bob is just using a counter. So in some cases, counters are okay. In some protocols, you cannot use a counter. So it's more common to find that nonsense are basically random numbers. Okay. So on that aspect, that random number generation is also very important in information security, for generating nonsense, for generating key values. We'll talk a little bit about when we talk about key management. But the basic idea is how you can do it is you can either generate them pseudo-randomly, or you can have true random number generation. True random number generation needs a random physical source, which most things don't have. It's actually very special to generate random numbers in that way. So generally speaking, most things are produced using pseudo-random functions. The pseudo-random function is, it produces something based on a formula, but if you just look at the result, you cannot predict the next one. So they look random, even though they're not truly random. So we can basically use a very strong pseudo-random number generator that will never repeat. Otherwise, we can just generate random numbers, store a value for all random numbers, and make sure we never use the same one. Or otherwise, we just use the random number to be really long. We generate it random, and we accept that there's a very, very, very unlikely chance that ever the nonce is going through. Okay. So in terms of when we're designing a protocol, we can think about different attacks that we want to prevent, right? So the first and the most basic one is masquerade. Remember we talked about masquerade attack? We said, okay, if the protocol is so broken that somebody can just pretend to be Alice, then we are dealing with a masquerade attack. So masquerade attack usually comes from a protocol that doesn't have proper data origin authentication. In other words, it doesn't require Alice to generate the message. Anyone can just generate the message. The next thing up is replay attack, right? So replay attack is prevented by freshness mechanism. If you don't have a good freshness approach, either through time-based, timestamps, logical timestamps, or nonces, then your protocol can be vulnerable to replay. The final attack is reflection. So reflection is a bit of a special case. Reflection happens if we do authentication using symmetric algorithms, right? I won't explain this now because it's easier to explain with an example, and we'll look at an example later when we get a little bit into the protocol. Right. So when we want to make authentication protocols, how do we go about designing and analyzing protocols in general? Right? So generally, any type of cryptographic protocol has some assumptions. The assumptions are what are in place before we even start. There is Alice and Bob. They have synchronized block. They already have a shared key, or Bob has a public-private key. These are things that are already assumed to be there before we even start. Then we have the protocol flow. So basically, who is sending a message to whom and when and what order. We have the protocol messages. So what is being sent between the two parties. And then we also have protocol action. So if I send a message to Bob, what is he doing with it before he's sending me a response? What is actually happening after the messages or during the messages are being exchanged, right? So also what we need to keep in mind is different aspects of the protocol. So obviously if we design a protocol, we have some security objective in mind. In other words, we want to be able to deliver something. We want to do something or achieve something, right? These security objectives will map onto a set of security requirements or cryptographic requirements that we have to build into the protocol. And after we have done so, we'll do final analysis to basically check the assumptions in the flow of the messages and the actions to make sure that these objectives are actually met. So if we do a very simple example, let's say we define some security objectives. So Bob wants to make sure that Alice was the source of an electronic purchase contract. Bob wants the contract to be enforceable at a later date. So he doesn't want to deny Alice to deny that she has entered into this contract. So if we map this down into protocol goals, in other words, security requirements that we need, or security services that we need, we see that we need data origin authentication, because Bob wants to verify that this message actually came from Alice. And in addition to that, Bob requires non-repudiation of the message. So he wants non-repudiation of origin. So basically, Bob makes a protocol, and he says, Alice is going to send to me a message and a MAC of the message, right? So in terms of assumptions, we know Alice and Bob have a shared key KB. In terms of message flow, there's one message between Alice and Bob. In terms of message content, the message contains the MAC of the message. And in terms of actions, once the message is received, Bob will verify the validity of the MAC, and if the validity of the MAC is correct, he knows that Alice has sent this message. So then we do the analysis and we say, okay, everything looks okay from a functional perspective. Does it actually provide us data origin authentication? Yes, because we have a MAC. Does it provide us with non-repudiation? Yes or no? Can a MAC provide non-repudiation? What's the only thing that can provide non-repudiation? Signature, right? If signature has only the one private key, only one private key can sign. MAC cannot provide us non-repudiation. So our protocol fails. It can do half, it can do the data origin authentication, but it cannot do the non-repudiation. So now we redesign it. So we say, okay, Alice is going to send a signature of the message to Bob. So in terms of our assumption, Alice has a public-private key. The flow is for one single message. The message data is a signature of the message to Bob. And the action is that Bob will verify the signature there. Now we do the analysis. We can say, okay, a signature provides us with origin authentication. Very good. A signature also provides us with non-repudiation. Right? And that is what we want. That was the goal that we wanted. And therefore, our protocol flows. Every single time we can think about what the protocol wants to do, you can define it, and then you can check if it actually works. Right. So let's look at some basic protocols. So in terms of authentication protocols and the examples that we give in the course, basically all of it comes from the ISO 9780 standard. Right? So these are actually real protocols that is being used for industry. Right, not just academic example. So in terms of notation, A and B are our identifiers, so it's the identity of Alice and Bob. TA is a timestamp made by Alice. RA is a random nonce generated by Alice. TAB is a shared key between Alice and Bob. In text, it's basically anything. It could be, a lot of the protocols just define some text. It is not for security purposes. It's if you want to exchange some other information between Alice and Bob at the same time. If we say encrypt underscore KAD X, it basically means X is encrypted with symmetric crypto using KAD. If we do MAC KAD X, it means we are doing the MAC of X using the shared secret key KAD. And if we do signature of X by A, it basically means that X is signed with the private key of A. Right. So let's look at the first protocol example. We have Alice and we have Bob. Alice sends to Bob the following message. A T timestamp meant by Alice, the identity of Bob, some other text that can indicate that Bob was in the list has been modified, although, and then encryption of everything with a symmetric encryption of everything using EAB. Okay. So I'll give you a minute to look at this protocol and you think about what is going on. What is the assumptions? What is the actions needed to be taken by Alice and Bob? And what is this an example for? Is this unilateral or mutual authentication? Who is authenticated to who? And why? one person getting authenticated to the other one, or are they both getting authenticated to each other? Let's see first. So Bob sends random number to Alice. So this message has freshness, right? Because Bob is sending a new random number to Alice. So this message has freshness. Very good. Does this message have data origin authentication? No, because there's nothing that says only Bob could have done this. Anyone could have done this. So the message that goes from Bob to Alice has freshness, but no data origin authentication. So Bob is not authenticated. So that means, at best, this is unilateral authentication. So Alice sends to Bob and Mac RA, RB, and B. So this Mac, he does data origin authentication, because it's something only Alice can do. Right? And inside it is a nonce that is fresh, new. Bob has used it new. So that means this message is fresh. Right? So now Bob has gotten from Alice a message that only Alice could have made with the Mac and contains the freshness, RB. Both conditions are satisfied, so Alice is authenticated to Bob. So this is a unilateral protocol where Alice is authenticated to Bob. Why is this Bob here? Where did this come from? Because we could have made it like this, and all the things would still be there. We would have freshness, and we would have data origin authentication. So what does this Bob actually do for us? So what this does is it provides us an indication of the direction of the message. So you can define this either way. If you put this identifier, it could say this message is intended for Bob. So the receiver is Bob. Alternatively, you could have put A here, which means the sender is A. Right? But most common people use, and I think the better way to do it is the recipient. So basically, I made this message. The intended recipient of this message was Bob. Why is this important? Remember I talked about the third attack previously. I said there's masquerade and there's no data origin authentication. There's replay and there's no freshness. And the third one is reflection. What if we don't put the B there? What happens now is Bob talks to Mallory and he says, I am Bob. You need to authenticate to me. Here is my random nonce RB. At the same time, Mallory goes off and replays it to Bob. So he says, I am Alice. I want to talk to you, but first you need to authenticate yourself to me. Here is nonce RB. But Mallory uses the same nonce as the one that Bob used to challenge her. Right? Bob, being the honest person that he is, then gives Mallory a valid answer, which is Bob macked with, no, it's Bob's nonce macked with EAB. It's actually Mallory's nonce. That is the same thing. Right? And then this response that Bob sends back to Mallory is also the correct response that Bob has expected Mallory to send back to him. Right? So basically what happens is Mallory reflects it back to Bob. Takes the response back from Bob, and basically reflects it back to Bob, and basically uses Bob to calculate the right response for her, which she then uses to send back to Bob. Mallory can also do the same thing. She could get this RB from Bob and then go find A, and say to A, hey, A, I am Bob, I want to authenticate to you, here is a random number. And then A, Alice will send back to her Mac, EAB, RB. Right? And then it will send it back to Bob. Right? But usually we don't assume that. We assume that there's only two parts. Right? So this is how it works. So by putting the Bob in here, what basically now happens is, if Bob makes this response, Bob's response would be like that, and the response that Bob expects back would be like that. So now the second message, this message here, is no longer the same as the message at the end. Right? Because we cannot reflect it anymore. Okay. Right. We look at two more examples and then we can end. Right. So, next example. So this is nonce and sign. The Bob sends nonce to Alice. Alice signs the nonce and sends back to Bob. Okay? So, in this case, who is authenticated to who? Is Bob authenticated to Alice, or is Alice authenticated to Bob? So if we look at the message that goes from Bob to Alice, it has freshness, but it does not have data origin authentication, right? Because anyone could have made this message. If we look at the message going from Alice to Bob, it has freshness because of the nonce. It has data origin authentication because of the signature, because only Alice could have done the signature, right? Therefore, Bob has a message from Alice that's fresh with data origin authentication. So Alice is authenticated to Bob. In this case, there's no little identifier B here. Right? However, it's probably also a good idea to put it in. But theoretically, we don't need it because we cannot reflect it. Right? For example, if this was instead Mallory, and Mallory would try to now do her trick with the reflection and send that to Bob, the response that will come back will be the signature of Bob's name, RB. But basically now you see that this response that Bob gives back is signed by him, and the response that Bob would expect back from Alice is signed by Alice. Right? So we don't have this problem with reflection that we would have had when we used symmetric crypto. Right? Because the signature already inherently tells us who the source of the message is. Because the sender is also the signer. Okay. One more and then we'll talk about this. Right. So, next one. Alice sends to Bob key A, the signature of key A and the identifier Bob. Bob sends to Alice key B, the signature of key B and A. Okay. Is this a case of unilateral or mutual authentication? Who is authenticated to who and why? Is Alice authenticated to Bob? So the message going from Alice to Bob is a signature of a timestamp made by Alice. So can we say that this message could only have been made by Alice? Yes, because it was signed by Alice, right? Can we say that this message has freshness? Yes, because it had a timestamp, right? So Bob has a message from Alice that only Alice could have made, and it's fresh. So Alice is authenticated to Bob. Is Bob authenticated to Alice? Yes, because the message is doing the same thing, right? Alice has a message from Bob that Bob has signed, so we have data origin authentication. And we have a timestamp that said that message is fresh, therefore both conditions are met, and that message is authenticated to Bob. Okay, so we're going to stop there for now. There's still a couple of examples left, but we'll do it after we have the midterm quiz. So what I want to do is, I just want to come up with the midterm quiz. Integrity. Remember, for the number theory, you should be able to do RSA other than the helmet. No long, not the theory only question. Okay? Questions similar difficulty to problem set 1 and tutorials. Okay? Of variety of difficulty. Okay? What you are allowed? You are allowed calculator. You are allowed notes. Okay? Notes can be on your PC. Notes can be on your tablet. Doesn't matter. Okay? If I walk through during the quiz and I see anything that's not PowerPoint or PDF, then I'm not going to be happy. Okay? So you can only have PowerPoint or PDF for your notes, right? But you can keep it on your computer, so you don't have to print out everything. Otherwise, everybody comes with like 400 pieces of paper. Okay? So during the quiz, I don't want to see anything else. You can't have WeChat open and your browser and all sorts of other things. Okay? Only the PowerPoint or the PDF, so you can do your notes. The warning is, even though you're allowed to bring your notes, study for it like it's a closed book test. Okay? Because the time is very limited. Right? So you do not have time, every single time you go to the next question, you don't have time to go to that part of the notes, read it, study, see if you can understand, and then apply it to the problem. Right? The notes are only there for you as a reference. So you should almost be able to answer the question in your head already from what you remember. But if there so happens to be a little thing that you forget, you can look it up in your book, in your reference notes. Right? If you refer back to the reference every single question, you are probably going to struggle to finish the midterm. Okay. So that is fine. Okay? So the time is limited. And then remember to check the Canvas. So remember that every week I upload those additional notes that goes together with the slides. And you can look on there what slides are important and which ones are not. So usually I'll write at the bottom, this slide is really important, you should probably study it. Or in the next 5 slides are really important, this is core stuff. Or I will say, this slide is really only there for interest. It's for you to understand, it's very interesting, but you're probably not going to get a direct question on this in the exam. Okay? So that could help you optimize a little bit what you study. Okay? So during this week when you are studying, if anything is not clear, send us some email and we are more than happy to help you answer anything. Okay? Also remember your calculator. If you don't bring your calculator, then some of the questions might be difficult. Not difficult, but I mean you can't really do like random calculations so you can. You probably can, but it's going to waste your time. So rather bring your calculator and be happy. Does anyone have any other questions about the midterm quiz? Yeah? I prefer you don't, but maybe you can. It's okay. If you use the calculator, as long as it's like a basic calculator, it's okay. As long as you don't use an online one, then it has to be a little app of your. The Windows default one is okay. That's fine. Can be scientific calculator. No, you cannot. There will be no big numbers. So no big numbers like in the problem set. So most of the numbers will be small, only for RSA out of the helmet, if there's a number. So you should be able to calculate it by hand. Right? So if you do it, if you, for example, do the extended decoding algorithm, maybe instead of having like 10 lines, maybe like 2 lines. Right? And number is small, so it should be easier. You might be able to do the manual process, but it won't be as long as the problem set. Okay. Any other question about the quiz? Okay. Everybody happy about the quiz? If you think about some question you want to ask about the quiz later,